I think I did. Okay. So we have this holiday, which we're not really certain of. It has certain aspects of idolatry contained within the names of the protagonists. But it has some really wonderful moral messages. One, Dina Machutin. You should give authority to the government that of the country you live in. How is this seen in the story of Purim? Mordechai is supposedly a minor official in the court. What does he do when he overhears a plot to kill the king? He reports it. Now, you could look at it in a different sense and say, okay, here's a Jew who has been taken out of his country into slavery, into servitude. He hears a plot to kill the king. What might be the normal reaction? Good. Instead, Mordechai wants the king to know his life's in danger. Okay. Was this a great king for the Jews up to this point? Obviously not. He doesn't even know who the Jews are, and when Haman wants to kill them all, he's, no problem, go ahead. So it's not for his sake that Mordechai does this. It's because he represents the government. We are supposed to give authority to the government that we reside under if it's just government. The only time you're supposed to rebel against it is when the government requires you to do that which Torah actually forbids. Murder. Lies. Think of Nazi Germany. We're not going closer. We're not going to open up the political discussion here.
I know.
All right. Not that I don't have my opinions. I just don't feel that the rabbi should be expressing those when he's on the pulpit or in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So the main messages of you need to be willing to risk yourself to help others. Esther's plight. She can be quiet and still be the queen. But everyone else dies. There's times that you need to put yourself at risk to save everyone. The messages are magnificent. And the rabbis recognize this. We're not even sure who brought the holiday forward. There is no link. In every other case, we have a text of some sort that gives us the link. We don't have that here. We have the Megillat Esther, which doesn't have God's name in it. Not once. It's the only text that we have that does not have God's name in it, which makes it suspicious by itself. We don't know the origin. We have nothing of the history other than what's in this scroll. Nothing we can verify it with. In every other case, we have the Book of the Maccabees, we have Josephus, we have with Hanukkah. In this case, we don't have anything. And yet the rabbis felt that the lessons contained within it were important enough to keep it as a holiday. But they also do something really interesting. Because they're not certain, it becomes the topsy-turvy holiday. Where you're supposed to get drunk enough where you can't recognize Haman from Mordechai. Where you were supposed to dress in costume. And mixing up of gender, as far as costumes. They didn't get rid of their beards. And by the way, I've maintained this when I've done the thing. The beard stays on. Exactly. My father was actually the funniest one ever in a dress. And he never had a beard. But seeing him in the dress, I want you to imagine this Marine Corps captain and federal judge wearing my mother-in-law's dress at the time, trying to figure out how to walk in this thing. But the idea was to make it something that was not normal. Something where it was topsy-turvy, literally, everything reversed. And they do this because they don't want it to be seen as too holy. They actually create a spoof holiday. Now, we've done something similar here in America. We took a Christian holy day, All Saints Night, and we made a spoof of it. And we call it Halloween. It's very similar to what we did with Purim, except for there was no holy day there to start with. The rabbis didn't want it to become a holy, holy day. It's a holiday. It's a festival of celebration, joy. And they looked and they said, even if you don't think it happened, what did happen was we went into captivity, and two generations later we were sent back in freedom. And that should be celebrated. And that was what Purim was supposed to be about. It was the return from Babylon and the rebuilding of the Second Temple. So we leave Purim, and then we come to
Passover.
In the original story of Passover, and the original requirements, we probably come closer to keeping the requirements of Torah with this holiday than with any other, as it originally was given. You shall tell your son or daughter on that day that this is what God did for me when I was led forth out of Egypt. The Haggadah is laid out step by step in the Talmud. It says if you don't discuss things, if all you do is follow all the steps, and you don't have a discussion of what it all means, you fail. You get rid of the chametz, and yes, the rabbis expanded the terminology of what chametz was, hugely. You get rid of the chametz from your house, you remove all this leavened product, you make the matzah. Now, we changed one thing, and we even recognize this change, and this is a difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazic, by the way. In the Ashkenazic communities, we recognize this change only by the inclusion of the tzoroah, the lamb bone, the shank bone on the plate. And that tzoroah represents the sacrifice. Because what we were supposed to do, the main observance in Torah was tell your children, get rid of the chametz, sacrifice the lamb and eat it. And you ate it standing. Sandals on your feet, staff in your hand. That's what the Torah says. We do it as if we were back in Egypt, and that night people were told, eat it standing up, ready to leave. The Sephardic community still eats one bite of lamb as part of the tradition. The Ashkenaz community actually forbid anyone to have lamb. This is always a fun time at my house when I was growing up. Half Sephardic, half Ashkenazic. And this was one that the Sephardic side won out. My grandfather finally gave in. And so we would have, Mom would roast the lamb. And as my father's tradition had been in his family, everyone got one bite. And it was eaten, you stood up to eat that bite. In the Ashkenaz community, they said, no lamb at all, not allowed. Because we can't do the sacrifice. The Samaritans, and by the way, you all know where that name comes from? The residents of Samaria. What was Samaria? Anybody? Anyone remember the history part?
Was it Northern Israel?
It was the Northern Kingdom. It was the capital of the Northern Kingdom. So when this kingdom split, after Solomon's son proves to be a total idiot, and the Northern Kingdom of Israel is founded in the Southern Kingdom of Judea. The Southern Kingdom's Judea's capital is Jerusalem. The Northern Kingdom's capital is Samaria. So who are the Samaritans?
Jews.
They are Jews. They are Jews who break with the temple and create their own temple up there. But they're still having the Kohens and the Levites. They're still following Judaism. The Samaritans still offer sacrifice on Mount Gerizim outside of Jerusalem. In Samaria, there's a mountain that they've say was the historical place. They go out, they sacrifice the goats, the lambs, they eat it standing. It's an amazing experience to go through one time, at least once. And they've been joined by the Karaites, those who say literal interpretation, and they've started to do it with them. So I'm simply going to tell you that this is probably, as I said, the holiday that we follow closest to what the Torah actually requires. And we took it a few steps, no question, but that's it. Along the way, we took a few missteps. Anyone know why corn was forbidden on Pesach originally?
When you say corn, you mean maize?
Yes.
Okay.
What we call corn. Do you know how that got forbidden? Specifically because of a mistake between the terminology of corn, referring to all
grains,
and the terminology of corn referring to maize. The original mistake was somebody assumed that corn existed back in the old days, because it talks about the corn ships of Rome, providing for the poor of Rome. And the interpreter put it down as corn. The rabbis who were making the decision of whether it was allowed or not understood, therefore, that it was from biblical time. It was not allowed because it's grain. And they forbid it. We had an interpreter to thank for the mistake. I'm serious. The Ashkenazi community went along with this. The Sephardic community was bright enough to say, no, that's New World. It's maize. It's not corn. Corn was the generic term for all grain. And the fact that we're calling this corn, the real name is maize. It's not no problem, eat it. Rice, when rice was first being discussed, the rabbis uniformly turned around and said, rice is allowed. After two generations of trying to get people to understand that rice was not forbidden, they finally threw up their hands and said, fine, you don't want to eat rice? We'll say it's not allowed then. Again, only in the Ashkenazi community. The original commentary about the issue of rice in the Ashkenazi community was, anyone who thinks it's forbidden is an idiot. I'm not joking. That is literally what the chief rabbi of Germany's comment on it is when it's first being discussed.
Why do they forbid it? Because it puffs up?
They finally gave in. They gave in because everyone said, you were dealing with the common person, Nathaniel, who was saying, well, it's a grain. And if it's a grain and it expands, it's chametz. And they were saying, no, it's different. Everything expands, chametz or not, if you add water. And they were, for two generations, they fought it. And the writings and the rabbis for those two generations, it's a riot to read. They're angry with their people. It's like, would you stop already? It's not forbidden. You're allowed to have it. And after two generations, they throw their hands up and they say, fine. You want to say it's not allowed? We'll go along with you. Fine, it's forbidden. Now you're happy.
Did they make up an exception rule or something?
No. They said, now you're happy? And the Sephardics looked and said, are you Meshuggah? And the Sephardic community maintained both maize and rice is acceptable and still do today. Conservative Judaism has gone back to the original documents and said, okay, we're going to reverse the mistake. We're going to allow rice and maize. And we're not going to tell you it's not allowed. And what about all these legumes? I can't even tell you where it comes from because research has been done. They can't find which rabbi originally said no, but it caught on. Green beans, soybeans, chickpeas. There is nothing in them that would constitute what we call chametz. And again, the Sephardic community never went there. It's called kitniyot. The Sephardic community always allowed kitniyot. The Ashkenazic went a little meshuggah and decided, hey, you know what? Better you shouldn't eat it than you should eat it and not be allowed. There's a problem with all this, though. There is a law in the Mishnah of the Talmud that says kashrut should not be made onerous in cost. The rabbis were very smart. They recognized that if you kept expanding these definitions of what is and isn't, not just with Passover, but in general, you can force people not to be able to observe. And so they said, kashrut should not be made onerous in cost. And if you start making all these kitniyot and everything else non-kosher Pesach, what happens? Passover becomes the most expensive holiday to actually observe. And for some people, impossible. So I'm in favor of what the conservative woman has done, both as a scholar looking at the material. I'm not that scholarly, but as one who actually has looked at it and studied it a little bit, and as a rabbi who's concerned about the cost factors. And my answer is, kidney oat, fine. Rice, fine. Maize, corn, fine. Make the effort to keep real chametz out. You got the grains. You know what they are from biblical time. Those eliminate, except for within the matzah concepts. Moving on. So we have Passover. Here's the link that people forget about. What do you do after first night goes, comes and goes, second night, what do you start? The Omer. Why?
Because after that, you get the Torah.
From the day they are told to leave Egypt and they march off, not the first night, but the next day, to the time they arrive at Sinai is 7 weeks. That's in Torah. And so we have this festival of weeks, because we went from leaving Pitom and Ramses, the cities that we had helped build as slaves, and we arrive at Sinai where we're given the Torah. And that was the culmination of the 7 week journey. So we have this 7 week period of counting the Omer to remind us of the journey. The Omer that was brought of grain each day when you were established. I find this fascinating because we were the only nation to ever do it without charging. Ancient Israel believed that no one should go hungry. That every Jew and every resident who was not Jewish but lived among us, you know, in friendship, should have enough to eat. So what they did was they said, each family is going to bring an omer of grain, or the equivalent will be sent to the temple during the counting of the omer. For every day, there will be this bushel of grain brought in. And the temple, the Levites, and the Kohens will make sure it's distributed throughout the year to those who need it. This past year, I tried to bring that into a modern context and said, for every day of the omer, count off the omer by taking a package of food. Can, box, anything. Put it aside. I don't care if you bring it every day to the temple, but put it aside. And at some point, when you bring it to the temple, make sure eventually you bring the 49 packages. Once a week when you come to Shabbat services, once every 2 weeks, when you, whatever. And we will bring it over to this day and it will be distributed to those who don't have. All of a sudden it becomes relevant. But the wisdom of it is that it was relevant back then. So we have the giving of the Torah. Once again, we added an extra day. The reason was people weren't sure what day it might actually be, the new moon in Israel, if you're living in Europe. Not quite sure. They add the extra day. But it's the day of the giving of the Torah. And that's the only thing really being celebrated. The other thing that we're not going to have time to get into, and that's okay because I gave you a good list that gives it to you all, is the fast days. You have all the fast days on here. We're going to go briefly, running right through them, though I'm not going to go into them in detail. The fast of the firstborn, obviously, the day before Pesach. The day of the morning of the first Seder. It's going to happen that night. The firstborn is supposed to fast. Remembering that, all the firstborn were killed. except for those of Israel. Or, by the way, it wasn't just the Israelites. Anyone else who did what? Anyone know? This is a good trivia question.
Put the blood on there.
Everyone who believed in Moses' proclamation and believed in God more than they believed in Pharaoh and put the blood on their doorposts was saved. It was not just the Jews. It was not just the Israelites. Because out of Israel, out of Egypt, we're told a mixed multitude, many who had painted their doorposts, they showed their faith in God more than Pharaoh. That's all it took. Psalm Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, Moses smashed the tablets on the 17th day of the fourth month, which is Tammuz. He came down from Sinai. This was seen as prophetic, since it was also the day that the walls of Jerusalem were smashed by the invading armies of Nebuchadnezzar. We have Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. You've heard enough about that in the past, I'm sure, so I'm not going there. However, I want you to know that Tisha B'Av is also supposed to be the holiday that turns from a day of mourning to a day of celebration. It's going to be the day that the Messiah comes. That's the tradition. Just as this was the day put aside for punishment, it will also be the day put aside for redemption. Psalm Gedaliah. Gedaliah was the Jewish governor of Judea. He was murdered by Jewish zealots. And remember this terrible act with Psalm Gedaliah, the fast of Gedaliah. Until modern time, we didn't quite get this. How could Jews murder another Jew? And then Rabin was assassinated. And all of a sudden it became clear. Zealotry exists in every people. There will always be a few Meshuggahs who go too far. Yom Kippur, you know that is the fast day. I'm not talking about that one at all. Aserah B'Tevet, the 10th of Tevet. Most of these days are really interesting because it's the number of the month. The 10th of Tevet commemorates the fall of Jerusalem. And finally, the fast of Esther.
Which of these days it's in the Torah itself?
None of them are in the Torah, except for Yom Kippur. Several of them are in the Bible. Tanit Bechorim is in the Bible. Tzam Tammuz is in the Bible as the fast of the fourth month. Tisha B'Av is referred to as the fast of the fifth month. Tzam Gedaliah is referred to as the fast of the seventh month.
Do we fast exactly as we do in Yom Kippur?
No. And here's a good, great question. One of the distinguishing issues between conservative and orthodox sometimes is the reasoning behind and so forth and how we observe. So we look at Tzam Bikurim is a fast that is from the morning until the evening, not from the day before. The fast of the firstborn in both. You usually have a Seudat, a feast of the firstborn. So the morning before the Seder, you have a study session which completes an entire book of Talmud, or Tanakh. And you're supposed to celebrate that as a requirement by mitzvah of having something to eat. So you can break the fast by having breakfast, and then you don't eat between then and Seder. The fast of Tammuz has a double meaning, the smashing of the tablets as well as the breaking of the walls. And conservative Jews, many of the rabbis of conservative Judaism have looked at it and said half of that reason is still valid, the other half is not. And so they've called for a fast that starts in the dawn, but proceeds only till noon, commemorating the breaking of the walls of Jerusalem. And why not? I'm sorry, commemorating the smashing of the tablets, not the breaking of the walls. Why? Because we now have Jerusalem once again. It was appropriate to fast when Jerusalem was gone. Tisha B'Av, the same thing. You start the evening before. If you go with the liberal side, they say at noon you may stop. You fast for the destruction of both temples, but that you don't take it to the full 24 hours because it's no longer out of our hands. It's back with us. We should have a day, partial rejoicing along with it. Tzom Gedalia, same thing. On the third of Tishrei, normally it's a fast that only is from morning until evening. And there is no half day on that one other than the fact that it's only morning to evening. It's not the full 24 hours. Asara B'Tevet, I'm going to tell you the same thing what we did with Tisha B'Av. They would start the evening before, and then at noon you would stop. Tanit Esther, it's an interesting one. It commemorates the fast that Esther herself did. My answer to you is, that's up to you. I know many rabbis who do not observe it. And I know many Orthodox rabbis who do not observe it. So it's a question mark. It's how you see the holiday itself and the purpose of the fast. I have chosen to take a middle ground with it. I will usually do a food fast. I will not do a drink fast. I will actually use that day for one of the Meshuggah things that my sister pushes on me for a fruit. She calls it a fruit purge. It means all I'm drinking all day is fruit juice. Trust me. It works to remind me that this is not a normal day. That concludes. We do have a session scheduled for next week. To be honest, I'm not sure we're going to have it because I think we've covered everything and I don't think we have a lot of uncovered business, which is why I put that last session in. The only thing I haven't done, which I'm really concerned about on one level, is asking you for the feedback that I asked you to keep your journals and write down questions as you read the materials and so forth. I think the way I'm going to handle this is ask you to send me those questions, email, dropping them off, whatever, and I will answer them in that way, and I will try to, but I'm really tempted, unless anyone here feels otherwise, to say we can cancel the last session.
We can have a party.
We're not available.
Hmm?
We won't be here, so.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to cancel the last session. I will try to make sure we get notice out to everyone. By the way, Wayne Horowitz did pass away yesterday.
Oh, that's
sick. As I announced last week, it was imminent. It did occur.
That was quick. Wow.
Mad cow disease does not take very long.
No. Mm-hmm.
And as I said last week, there is no cure, and all you can do is palliative. And the funeral is taking place up north.
How's his wife doing?
I have not spoken to her since. I called and left messages for her, but I have not spoken to her, so I can't answer.
Okay.
All right. So, hopefully I'll see you all on Rosh Hashanah, if not before.
I'm going to miss these classes. Can we have more?
I'm going to try to come up with more courses, but not these.
Well, no, I mean more courses.
Yes. I am going to have other adult ed courses.
All right.